This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at HomeTeam.com.
When I came back to this community, connecting with my elders and understanding the dynamics of what this neighborhood once was, the greatness, what happened, and then it allowed me to be able to formulate a plan of what we were going to be looking to do.
Welcome to the Color of Money podcast. It is Bowman Keady, and I'm really excited today to be joined by my amazing co-hosts, Julia Emmerich and Daniel, for another conversation about money, wealth, and impact in the Black community. And we're super excited today to be joined by someone who I've had the privilege of seeing operate over the last number of years, someone who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, Anthony Kimball. So Anthony, thank you for joining us. Anthony's a recognized leader in the Baton Rouge community. He's the founder and managing partner of Kimball Properties, which is a real estate investment development company. He's been a really avid mentor, I know, in his community with youth basketball and other programs. Anthony is an amazing guy. He's a serial entrepreneur. He is a passionate and dedicated social activist, and he's somebody who is making a difference every single day in the world today while building an amazing company. So we're really excited to have you with us today, Anthony. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate y'all having me on today.
I always just like to kick it off with some of our guests about just how you got into the business that you're in today. And how'd you end up focused in the community that you're focused in?
Real estate kind of found me in a sense of I was 24, 25 working in Accenture in the corporate world. And I bought through like the guidance of my mother. I purchased my first property, inner city property. I think I paid like $11,000 for it, for this property. Between myself, my mom's construction team at the time, we rehabbed the property. We rented the property out for a year and, you know, had a kind of low income tenant. And just that property taught me so much about like people, the impact housing has on them. I eventually had to evict this tenant, you know, so it just taught me a lot. And it really also just showed me the impact that producing like a healthy environment for like a family, like what impact that could have on them. Learned a lot of lessons from that first property. And I've been around real estate most of my life. While I was in college, my parents had became real estate investors and also agents. And while I was in Stanford in undergrad, I worked in private equity and an asset management firm that did real estate. So from there, you know, one, I saw the impact real estate can have. And then when I left Accenture, I was working for this sports agency that managed a couple of my close friends that I grew up with. And like a lot of athletes, you know, professional athletes, these guys would get offered all kind of just business deals. Let's, you know, open a record label, nightclub, invest in this, invest in that. And when I started to scale in real estate, it really was to keep a lot of these guys and get them into just good business deals or just not deals that were so risky. You know, instead of like opening the club, or opening the restaurant, hey, you know, what do you think about just buying a building and finding a tenant or buying some houses and finding some tenants? It was the product that I knew best because I had some knowledge of how real estate worked and investing in real estate to be able to de-risk and not do some things that we didn't have as much knowledge of.
So you come from this background, which I always find fascinating about you, Anthony. And I see the way you move and the way you engage. It comes to me almost like you're leading a movement on the ground. Yet you come from a background and a set of experiences that are fairly corporate and elite in nature. And it would have been probably pretty easy to pursue your real estate career in a more corporate environment or a more, you know, to go work at a private equity firm or do something like that. Talk to me a little bit about how you found yourself into doing the type of real estate investing you're doing today.
I always tell people one about myself. I've seen both sides of the tracks. You know, neither one of my parents graduated from college. I'm an only child, but my parents always really worked their butt off to put me in the best situations. So like, I understood that, like, hey, my parents couldn't pay for college and stuff. So like, I had to do my best academically, do my best athletically to like be able to achieve the things that I wanted to achieve. And my parents put me in the right environments, and I truly made the most of it. So, you know, that's one thing. Talking about working in like the private equity world. So, you know, sometimes, you know, I look at him like, well, why didn't I take that route? Because, well, as you know, with some of the work we do with some of the neighbors we're in, it's tough. But I was blessed to live in Chicago, spend some time in Miami, spend some time in Houston. And I was seeing a very common theme of like these inner city Black communities near downtown that were being gentrified. Typically, they had some of the same characteristics, you know, where a freeway had been built through them. The fabric of the community had been destroyed because of some of these things, such as redlining and things like that. When I decided that I was going to come back home to Baton Rouge and New Orleans, where our portfolio's at, I looked at some of the things I'd seen around the country and then tried to identify neighborhoods that I thought some of these things were going to happen. It really got sped up in New Orleans as far as how the urban core of New Orleans was gentrified. When you talk about Katrina and how that storm impacted the urban core and what things resulted from that. And then looking at this South Baton Rouge neighborhood, it just had a lot of the characteristics I had seen in Third Ward Houston, places like South Dallas, Oak Cliff, some of these neighbors, Midtown, Atlanta. So I'd seen some of these neighborhoods that were near downtown, freeway built between them, typically smaller pockets where Black communities were between like white wealth, say downtown and like the Garden District or this uptown type area. So that was how we identified the community that we work in Baton Rouge and the communities that we work in New Orleans through some of the things I'd seen in other cities that were maybe 10 to 15 years ahead trend-wise of what we're seeing in some of these communities and these smaller to mid-sized cities that we work in Louisiana.
You said before we started recording, you were talking about Black Flight and we're removing the resources and we're removing the businesses and everything. But then on the other side of that, you have gentrification. So how do you win? Like if you remove the Black people, the Black businesses that take that step up, then we damage the community in that sense. But then if gentrification comes in, then we also damage the community. How do you win then?
Within my firm, we look at that a little different as far as gentrification. Gentrification at the part of like that word, uplifting of the community, we don't feel that's a bad thing. Where we find issue is what we consider colonization, where people are only going to come in this community, buy up everything, open businesses, and the only opportunity left for the folks that are in the neighborhood is those very marginal jobs. And that's the thing I think folks that look like us have issue with, is when we don't get to take part in the appreciation of our neighborhoods or take part in any role within these businesses that are coming that's going to be able to uplift our financial situation. And when you look at what's happened at a lot of, you know, our bigger markets around the country, as far as our historic Black neighborhood, it's more what we call within my firm is like colonization, where we don't take part in any of that uplifting.
So a question about that, Anthony, you make a good point and you say it so eloquently, but for a lot of people, particularly imagine we're selling a house to a first time home buyer. First thing that most of those people want to do is buy a house outside of where they're currently living, which is typically a lower income area. They say, I want to get out of here and buy a house anywhere but here. And for a while, that fascinated me because it was fine for you to live there and rent it, but it's not fine for you to live there and own it. And so how do you reconcile those two thoughts or those two theories? I want to buy something, but not here because maybe there's drugs or gangs or whatever, violence, whatever it may be. And people would live there renting, but they would not want to buy there.
It's a very complicated question because until cities are comfortable disproportionately spending in Black communities versus the suburbs, the problem is going to continue being the same. If you're like, you know, these low-income neighbors are here, the suburbs are here, we've disproportionately spent over the last 60 or 70 years on these suburban and white communities, but we still want to keep the spending equal, it's just going to keep moving like this.
Well, I think that the other piece of that, Julia, is those that have kids is you're chasing school districts. And unfortunately, where you're trying to rebuild these communities, the schools aren't the best. So even if you wanted to buy in the same neighborhood, you're going to be staying in that education system that you want better for your children anyway. So it's almost like we got to start with the schools and then start building the communities around the education and infrastructure piece before you get to the single family home reconstruction and such.
And that's deep, Daniel. It's something that we have to take a look at when we start taking a look at ownership and what ownership really means. And I want us to wrap our brain around this. Property taxes. We do have this slight where they just had not invested, even where they were primarily home ownership communities. Now, when they flip to a tenant-based community, it changes the whole perspective and conversation even worse, because property taxes pay for municipal services, right? Property taxes pay for police, property taxes pay for schools, property taxes pay for services. When you have a tenant-based community, the political structure does not even recognize that tenant-based community because they don't feel like they have to, because the residents in that community don't pay taxes. So therefore, they don't feel like they should give the services to those residents when you really take a look at it. When you flip that and you go to a homeowner-based community, there's a little more attention paid because, number one, it's been proven that homeowners vote more than tenants vote typically. The tenants don't pay property taxes, so they're not even entitled to the municipal services because they don't own the property. And so now you have this thing where you have a tenant-based community that's completely disconnected because the political structure does not even recognize them as a viable voting bloc, which is crazy. But I'm going to go into a situation in D.C. Remember when they raised the theater over on M Street? Mm-hmm. Remember, there were some apartment buildings in front of the theater. When they wanted to raise the theater, the tenants at the apartment building, they went to the city council. They said, we don't want and we oppose them raising the theater. Well, they lost because the city and the developers said that you all are tenants. If the landowner and the building owner does not complain about blocking the views, we don't have an issue. The tenants couldn't complain because the tenants didn't have a stake in the community. So whatever happened with the theater was going to happen with the theater unless the building owner complained.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
I want to piggyback off of this. Part of the conversation of what you just said, right, is this question of ownership. And we just talked about, and I think, you know, it's what I love about Anthony is this broader global perspective of the systems at work that are creating the societal issues that we see, right? And we as a people can sometimes be really thoughtful about that. But the flip side of that, which I think, Anthony, that you've been doing is saying, okay, great. So how can I show up in a way that I actually do have standing? And how can the historical things that have been used to oppress me create a business opportunity, right? So how is the freeway existing in this place that was used to divide a potential opportunity to turn that whole system on its head, moving in the other direction? And I think that's the heart of your business. And so I'd be really interested to think about this in light of what Imrik's talking about, like having agency. If we are outside, if we're just outside observing, commenting, you know, throwing our two cents at the wall about what's happening to us, versus saying, okay, that creates a stream of information, a stream of activity that may times not actually be in our interest. But if I understand the flow and the direction of something, I have an opportunity to insert and be an actor in it. And I think that's what you've done. And so I'm really interested in this idea of, okay, so you told us about all this stuff that's happening is negative. So what are you actually doing and how does that create a business opportunity for Kimball Properties?
I'll start before I talk about what we are doing with talking about one thing that was important for me and the reality in a lot of these neighborhoods that these once were thriving communities. Let's start there. So we're not recreating the wheel because a truth I believe is if you don't know where you came from and that you once were great, it's hard for these kids to believe that they can be great because a lot of times they, especially in a neighborhood like South Baton Rouge, you ask a lot of the youth today, they don't realize South Baton Rouge used to be a thriving Black community with like some greats have come out of this neighborhood. So that's one thing for us was for me first when I came back to this community was connecting with my elders and understanding the dynamics of what this neighborhood once was, the greatness, what happened. And then it allowed me to be able to formulate a plan of like what we were going to be looking to do. And one thing that was then important for the work we're doing here is to be present. My business is in South Baton Rouge. The home when I live, I'm in Baton Rouge, is literally two blocks from my business, right on one of the main thoroughfares, because I wanted to be present here and understand all of the dynamics of this neighborhood. And when we're putting my business here, I wanted people to be able to see that you could have a business and thrive. And if I'm going to be making money in this community, I wanted to be here, which was interesting because my mom salutes everything I do. But when I told my mom I was moving to South Baton Rouge, that was the first time my mom got concerned. You sure you want to live over there? You know, you're about to have my grandbaby. Like it was a concern. It was a real conversation that I had to have with my mom. I love my mom to death. One of my best friends, you know, and I'd be like, well, mom, this is what we're doing. I need to be present. Because the reality with what we're doing residential development, we're doing commercial development. But how I truly change the dynamic of this neighborhood, if I can get folks like everyone on this podcast to be willing to move in South Baton Rouge, that's how we truly change South Baton Rouge. Because the reality of when that kid next door tells me that he's interested in working in the development world or wants to be a real estate agent, and I know both. And Bo lives on the same street and Bo sees this kid. And just from that being present and seeing each other and having more conversation, it's a lot easier to get that kid his first internship and open opportunities up for him.
But like Daniel said, but at what expense, right? So agreed. Yes, if we all move to the same community to uplift the community from the inside out, at what expense are we expected to do that? For example, I moved out of the hood. It took me a lot of time to get my two kids out of the hood. It was a lot of money I had to save up, you know, and then I actually did when I got married, we intentionally moved back because my husband at the time was running for public office and the ward or whatever. And so we moved back into the hood. I believe it's one of the worst things I ever did because it put my youngest son in an environment that he had no business being in. Right. So I love the idea of the collective of moving into the community, but at what expense? When it's going to potentially put you in a school district that is not the best school district for your kids, it's going to potentially put your children in an environment where they may get into drugs and gangs and get shot. So at what expense are we expected to, going back to your point, really solve a problem we didn't create and that someone else should be investing in because it was systemically done?
The reality of it is just one or two Anthony Kimballs don't get it done. It has to be an ecosystem, has to be a collective, and it has to be a real plan. And that's what typically is lacking in our communities. And I don't say this as a negative thing because there are so many generational traumas and things that lead to this, that it's hard for us as the people to have the cohesiveness to play the long game. And that's why when just the Anthony Kimball pops up in the neighborhood doing what he's doing, or just you move back into the neighborhood. And, you know, because the ecosystem, the planning, we're going to work the school system issue. A couple of us, we're going to work the local government issue and make sure the resources, the CDBG funds are here, the home funds are here. A couple of us, we're tied in with the police force And we're going to, you know, work and make sure that we're starting a crime district or economic district where we can have surveillance and cops in our neighborhood and that we're hiring within. We typically, as a people, don't have the resources and the cohesiveness to do that. And that's what makes it tough. And I'll say this, I'm talking about a lot of the stuff we're doing as far as commercial development, residential development. But let me take a step back and tell you, it's been hard as hell. Like gut-wrenching hard at times where like I've had conversations with my wife multiple times of like, what the hell are you doing? And I've had instances where things have happened. You know, I'll tell you one specifically. I had a kid that worked for me and did demo for me about a year and a half ago, get killed walking to the corner store after literally 45 seconds after me talking to him and asking him if he was coming to work that day. He told me, no, boss man, I'm chilling today. I keep driving down the street. I hear gunshots. I get a call. Let D got killed. I'm the second person on the scene trying to get his kid, you know, to the point my staff had to tell me that day, Kim would just go home. And, you know, part of like why I was so messed up that day, because all I could think about is my son. Like, does it make sense to raise my son in this environment? Like, what am I doing to him? Who are his friends going to be? To the point I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't operate that day and I just had to go home. What keeps me here is one of the things is that I know with my background, Stanford, Tulane grad school, the knowing people like Bo, knowing people in Silicon Valley, that like what I can bring into this neighborhood just from a pure capital sense is very rare. And that if I don't do it, probably no one will. Because being from this city with the connections I have, not many that look like me have it and that are willing to take the financial risk and the years of, like, I know I could be at a private equity firm making hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars right now. And I'm willing to sacrifice that for the greater good of my community. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. I don't know if I'm purely crazy for doing that. But I know if I'm not willing to do it, then who has that opportunity?
Is there a way that instead of feeling like you have to do it, is there a way that we could collectively have the organizations, the governments, the things that you're saying that cause these practices and policies to take accountability and responsibility? So it's not on Anthony Kimball. It's not on your family. It's not on even if it was the six of us. And let me give you an example of what I mean. Like, I remember when they had asked the basketball player Jaylen Brown what he was going to do with his money to close the wealth gap in the Black community. And his answer was beautiful. And I was upset that they even asked the question, why is there an expectation on him to solve a problem he didn't create? So what could we collectively do instead of potentially you having to say, I don't know if what I'm doing is right or wrong? Is there something we could collectively do to have the banks, the government, the practices, the billions of dollars that created these issues be held accountable and take action instead of us individually having to solve a problem we didn't create?
The easy answer is they should be. The reality of it is that's not how politics works.
That's right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just not how it works, you know, because at the end of the day, even when you have Black leadership, a lot of times they're not funded through Black pockets.
Right.
And at the end of the day, politicians move on who fund them. Lobbying works on what business is paying them. Do you try to empower the next generations to like infiltrate those institutions and like try to then, you know, get those resources redirected? Or we just say we have to build our own institutions? You know, I don't know what the answer is there.
Isn't it complicated and also though very simple, right? And this is where I'm really interested in understanding what you've learned, Anthony, in this idea that ultimately it is about economics and it is about a power structure. And until you find a way to effectively create economics through something that starts to shift the existing structure, that's the only thing that shifts. You're not going to go begging at the door of the structure, asking it to change itself. Asking is a position of weakness, just the fact you got to be asking. So the question is, how do you use the existing structure, which I think you've started to do in some ways? It's been very difficult, but like, what are the wins in getting the economics of the existing structure to turn in your favor?
We've raised about $7 million in equity to invest in the South Baton Rouge neighborhood, invested over all of our projects between probably about $25 to $30 million versus real estate. Everything from single family housing, mixed use developments. We're part of this development called Electric Depot, which is about 50,000 in commercial, 16 apartment units, host of 4 or 5 restaurants, clothing store. So one of our next projects, Hotel Lincoln, we'll be revitalizing an old hotel, one of the first Black hotels in Baton Rouge, on the Chitlin Circuit. James Brown, Aretha Franklin all stayed there in this heyday. We'll be turning that into 12 affordable units and 2 commercial bays. I'm sitting in my home office. It's called Legacy on 14th Street, 6,000 square foot office space, event space. We have 9 offices here, 4 different companies, small event space, conference room right in the heart of South Baton Rouge. So we opened this office space about 4 years ago to bring, businesses like mine and other businesses and have them operate. We also have a nonprofit, Step Up Louisiana, which does a bunch of voter registration and other things within the community. We're actually about to open a resource center in this space through a nonprofit called Metromorphosis. There'll be telehealth options and other just services for folks in the community. I think we're up to probably about 40 plus residential units in this one community. So we're geographically focused. Probably 90% of our portfolio is right in the South Baton Rouge area, inner city historic Black neighborhood, between downtown and the Garden District, freeway built through the heart of the community. I live here, work here. And the other great thing is I'm seeing other developers come in this neighborhood. We just had a huge road diet on Government Street where the state put the bike lanes and stuff and the other major thoroughfare through the neighborhood. Terrace is about to get a $10 million refresh where they'll have bike lanes, new lighting, and stuff like that. So I tell people if we're talking about a 9-inning baseball game, we're probably in about the 3rd or 4th inning. But you're starting to see a real transition within this community.
Through all of your community work, your philanthropic work, and this service, is it an avenue to make money? Can you do good and make money at the same time?
Yeah, you can. You can.
Okay.
Yeah, you can.
Can you make good money and do good at the same time?
You can.
Okay. And I just want people to know that. So in that space of inspiration, people don't say, well, I hear all these good things he's doing. He's living over there. Is he making any money? The answer is, hell yeah, Anthony making money, and he's doing good, and he's changing the community, he's having an impact. So that's an inspiration for more people to just explore the possibilities.
That's how you get more than 2 Anthony Kimballs.
Yeah.
We are, unfortunately, running up against our time. It's been an amazing conversation, and maybe we'll have to have you back sometime to get into the tactics of what you're doing, because we've really covered a lot of the global piece. But one of my takeaways is that it's a structure and ecosystem that got us to where we are today. And it's an evolved structure and ecosystem that's necessary to bring us to where we could be tomorrow. And so I think the question for all of us that we've had opportunity to talk about today is, what are the actions, the things we can do that start to shift that ecosystem? And how can we do that in a way that is appropriately resourced, that can build wealth for ourselves and for the communities in which we live and work? And it's just great to have you with us, Anthony, and to share with us your perspective and all the amazing work you're doing.
Keep fighting a good fight, brother.
Oh, we'll do that. We'll do that, man. Appreciate you all, man. Appreciate you all you having me on today.
All right. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Thank you, Anthony.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not KWRI and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.